You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome back to Stay Ahead, a BI Norwegian Business School podcast. This episode is part of Strategy as Practice series, where practice meets theory and theory meets practice. Today's topic is a board of directors' perspective on how to manage complex dynamic environments and disruptive events. And today, I have the pleasure of having with me Trond Berger. He's the chair of board of Yara since May 2020. And Yara will be the main context of the conversation today. He's also the CEO of Blommenholm Industrier, who has major financial holdings and a strategic 26% ownership in Schibsted. He's also the chair of board of Arctic Asset Management. Prior to joining Blommenholm Industrier, he was with Schibsted as executive vice president for 20 years. And he's lucky enough to have education from BI Norwegian Business School. Welcome.
Thank you, Thomas.
I'm also joined by Professor Øystein Fjelstad. He's professor at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI. Before joining BI, he actually worked for Accenture for 8 years. He has a Bachelor of Economics and Business Administration from Norwegian School of Economics, and both a Master's in Management Information Systems and a PhD in Business Administration from the University of Arizona. Øystein actually worked with Telenor for 25 years and had Telenor professorship for 15 years. He even had a job for 3 years, a job which didn't formally exist as a member of a divisional executive team. His areas of expertise are value creation, organizational design, and business models. Welcome, Øystein.
Thank you, Thomas.
My name is Thomas Borgen, and I'm an industrial PhD candidate at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI, and will be your host today. For those unfamiliar with Yara, it is a Norwegian company founded in 1905 to solve actually the emerging famine in Europe. Today, Yara has more than 17,000 employees, turnover of some $16 billion, and operating in more than 60 countries. Yara is a world leader in crop nutrition and agriculture solutions. Trond, as I understand it, Yara is driven by three global challenges: food shortages, limited farmland, and air pollution. And as we now have recognized, the war in Ukraine is having major impacts on both the food and fertilizer industry, with Russia and Ukraine both being significant in the global value chain, and Russia being one of the world's largest producers and exporters of essential crop nutrients and natural gas. And I note that Yara repeats its concern for global food security and calls on government actions to protect food supply chains and decrease dependency on Russia. So could you kind of take us through your and the company's perspective on this?
I mean, the geopolitical situation has changed dramatically, as you know, and Yara has been aware of this potential food crisis for quite a long time. I've had close contact with the UN food program, and since Yara is producing fertilizer, if you should have a crop, and the crop in a way to have the best production, then fertilizer will increase that up to 50% if you use it. And you should use then the best precise farming. So that's why it's so vital for Yara and for the world in order to have enough food production. Today, the sourcing that Yara need is dependent on Russia, and we need to find some alternative sources, of course. So we'll be working heavily on that. But the increased gas prices, which is an input factor into the fertilizer, and also some of the other sourcing product. And then they have, the food prices have increased dramatically. So more than double. And that, of course, works in a way for the rich countries. But for the poor countries, it is a real danger, I would say. For if you look at the history, unrest has often been driven by food and food prices in poor countries. So this is something that is of a concern for Yara, but also for the political stability in parts of the world. So this Yara and has been, I would say, in close contact with UN and the politics in EU and Norway in order to convey this story.
But more concrete, what should politicians or you and or we as citizens of this world do differently to help to solve this crisis?
Well, I think we all need, in a way, to look at the production and sourcing and be more independent. This globalization has led to that in a way. It is based on stability. That's not really the case. I think that you need now to ensure that you have enough capacity in parts of the more stable world. And that's something that I think is key going forward. Now it means then that China is really looking forward to supply their own home farmers. India has enough with itself. And Russia is out of the picture, so that's why you need stability in the rest of the world in order to be able to deliver food and food security.
We will discuss that more and how Yara kind of plays a role in this. But it's very interesting and fascinating that Yara, being one of the major players, are taking on a bigger role than just the company perspective. It's taking a real stakeholder perspective, which I think is very, very well done. Øystein, I have noted you saying that simplicity is the only thing that can conquer complexity. Is that the reason why you, and I believe you say it with a smile, you call yourself a simple man?
Well, I think of myself as a simple man. I hope in some ways I am simple. I prefer simple over complicated, and particularly in people I deal with. But there is something here. There's a bit of a paradox. I've borrowed that phrase, by the way, from Professor Kathy Eisenhardt at Stanford, who's also an honorary doctor at BI, where there's an interesting contrast here, because an organization, it does need to match the complexity in its environment, but it cannot match it in a static way. So the ability to adapt becomes a premium, and that requires simplicity, and it requires generativity, the ability to create the structures, the solutions you need when you need them, rather than our classical, we're going to sort it all out, plan it, and then implement it over the next 5 years. And I think, as Trond is saying here, you know, the characterization of the world that you're describing and that Yara very much participates in is one of a high degree of complexity and a high degree of unpredictability. And I think that what we're seeing at the moment across a large number of organizations is that they're starting to more and more organize for the ability to adapt when needed. To be resilient and to be adaptive.
Exactly. And I think that's something we will need to deep dive as we move on the conversation. And that leads me actually to a follow-up question to you, Trond. And there is, and I think all listeners can relate to this, and you in particular, who sits as a chair of Yara, that the business environment of Yara is going through profound changes. It could be the agriculture industry itself, as you mentioned, the value chain of food, climate changes, digitalization, just to mention a few. So let me start then with maybe a simple question, but maybe not a simple answer. And let me phrase it this way. As a diverse and truly global organization, how do you and the board prepare and oversee an organization with such a large scale and rapid environmental changes, kind of what Øystein alluded to?
Well, I mean, it's Yara is in midst of this, and it is a transformation. It is going fast. So I think that if you take it on the board perspective, because we have, when we are setting the yearly board agenda, we have said that we would like to allocate around 60% of our time in the board meetings to new business, new initiatives, which is quite significant because the challenge for a board in a complex situation is that there's so many, so to say, both stakeholders, it is governance, it is in a way reporting and all these things that you need to deal with, but it tend to take too much time. You should ensure that you have a system that you can in more monitor and tick off a lot of those. Not always so easy, fair to say, but that's the direction you would like the board work to be done, so that you have enough time to discuss and deep dive into the new initiatives, the changing. So so that's something we are spending a lot of time on. One example is ammonia is input factor into the fertilizer, and that you also can use in as a clean ammonia, meaning green production into the ammonia. And ammonia is very efficient in a way to use in vessels on the sea. So that's, as an example, it could be a huge opportunity in the future. And we, as a board, as an example here, we spend a lot of time to understand the potential in the clean ammonia future, so to say. That is an alternative to hydrogen, in especially in the shipping industry. So, as an example.
But just to go further on your point about, which is very impressive, that at least you have the ambition to use 6% of the board's time to think about opportunities, instead of maybe focus more on classical board reporting, which is also important for the governance point of view. But now we've been through quite disruptive and very dynamic environments, put it mildly. Are you still able to have that perspective to look at opportunities, or is it now more looking at the threats and the downside as we are in the midst of what we are?
Yeah. No, fair to say, we are, of course, impacted by what's going on in the geopolitical situation. And we have spent a lot of time on, first of all, we had sourcing from Belarus, which was very challenging when it comes in a way to the government there and sanction, etc. So that ended up that we withdraw from that. So, but that we spent a lot of time on how to deal with the Belarus situation. Because, you know, as a challenge in a way for many companies is that you have activity in parts of the world that don't comply with normal, so to say, standards that we in the Western world, in a free democracy and all this space, then if you ask what has been in a way the guiding principles in Norway is that you should be in those countries, because if you withdraw, then it becomes worse for those being there. So as an example, in Belarus, we that was a supplier on a mining there, and we knew that if Yara withdraw as the main customer to that mine, then Russian or Chinese interest will come and overtake that position. And they have they have not the same standards for workers, etc. So it becomes worse for those running that or actually working in that mine, just as an example. Mm. Then, of course, it is important that Norwegian companies continue to be do the best in this situation. This has been also a little bit in the press lately. I think that's something that I would like to say that's important in itself.
Exactly. But that, to lift it one level up, because I think it's a very good example, but how do you kind of prepare or develop capabilities in an organization which need to handle all these even disruptive events, but maybe the very dynamics? How do you think about developing those, and how do you organize for that?
Now, in this crisis in Ukraine, in Belarus, then you typically have a task force handling that and setting a team that knows the situation. So that's typically led by one head of sourcing or some similar to this, focusing very much on action plan in order to deliver that and report back to, typically to the top, to the deputy CEO or the CEO, as an example.
Øystein, I mean, I know you're in the final stages of writing a new book calling Designing Adaptive Organizations. And I think just listening to Yara, it's about how do you adapt the organization to constantly changing environments. Could you kind of elaborate on your thinking here?
Yeah, I think that the Trond provides a perfect context. I think we have to recognize that the way we currently organize, we've sort of done for about 2,000 plus years. We sort of figured out how to structure things and then use those structures. And that's fantastic, even in a complex world, but it requires some degree of stability. It is less suited to a world that changes a lot. And so some typical aspects of these modern organizations that are really rolling out the last 10, 15 years, and they're becoming more the new normal, are that they are flatter. And flatter actually works rather well for a Norwegian company. We're sort of naturally flat. We have more of an egalitarian mindset throughout the society. And I think that helps in terms of being able to adapt. They're more open. So they work more broadly, interact more broadly with their environment. And I note also that, you know, Yara extensively collaborates with a lot of other actors internationally and in Norway in terms of the efforts you're taking on. And they are more temporary, as you're saying, with the task forces. And I think that something that we at this point may be thinking of, well, this was the exceptional situation, so we moved to, you know, a task force structure, et cetera. I think we may have to get used to that being the new normal, that we have to sort of start thinking more about the organizing as a verb rather than the organization as a noun, and that it's in the ability to fluidly move through these things. Because we've in a short period of time, or 2 years, we've had COVID, we have the Ukraine situation, we have the whole chip supply from China. And I don't believe that these 2 years were the period in the 21st century where everything moved and then we went back to some stable state. And that, I think, means we're going to have to really think hard about how we organize. And that's actually what this book is about. It's Designing Adaptive Organizations. So all of the chapters deal with various aspects and mechanisms and means that enable organizations to organize fluidly, as you're describing, Trond.
Yeah, I think that you're touching upon something very important to have a dynamic organization. And if you take another example, if you take the digitalization, I mean, that goes across a lot of most companies. And how should you organize for digitalization in a typical large corporation? It is not easy because then you have to have that in some kind of matrix system. You need, in a way, somebody that has that responsibility and has enough accountability and getting in a way are able to execute on delivering on digitalization. So that is just talking now about my previous experience. I'm talking about Yara. You know that if you, as an example in Yara, to reach the farmer with digital products through the mobile phone, meaning that you can optimize your fertilizer on the ground. You have a lot of data, and you know, can in a way just monitor that on the field, and you can in a way get input. This is a then you in longer term you can also press button and you can order and you can. It's a seamless process. That's the future, and that change is dramatic. And the question: how should you organize Yara in order to best deliver on that digital journey? Because if you are in a way head of France or head of Europe and you have so many other things that you should focus on in a way to optimize production, in a way to do that. So it goes very much to the heart of this change and how to organize some kind of matrix system in order to deliver on that journey. I think that is something that all organizations are facing, not only Yara, by the way.
I think this is a really interesting challenge, as you say, that everyone faces at the moment, because the digitization is pervasive. It sort of cuts through absolutely everything, and it's both an enabler of the organization to change, but at the larger scale, it's also what in part drives the need to change, because things simply move faster as a result of it. And coming back to what you're saying about the, you know, the use of artificial intelligence to advise farmers very specifically on how to grow a particular crop, the interactions are digital. Everything becomes digital. All the activities, all the resources, and as they do, it also opens up for alternative ways of organizing things. And I think this is both an opportunity and it's also a major challenge. Some of the organizations that I've been looking at, they appear to take on organizing models that look more like how the internet is organized than how the Roman army was organized a couple of thousand years ago. And the internet is the largest, most resilient system we have ever created. But the internet is mostly self-organized. Because internet itself is digital, that also enables a different way of organizing the mechanisms within it. And I think herein lies a huge potential transformation, because we need sort of some of the things that the matrix was able to do in terms of connecting things all through, but we don't need the rigidity of the matrix in its classic form. So we're probably looking for a hybrid between the matrix organization and the internet.
And I think it will be interesting now, because I think a lot of the listeners can relate to the digitalization from the farmers and backwards. But what is, I think, also fascinating is that you mentioned that in 2021, you launched the biggest digital production initiative, basically building digital twins, which I think is where you're trying to replicate, I think, the physical assets. Can you explain your thinking behind it and how that's going to drive maybe changing the business model, adjust the business model, or make it more efficient?
I think the digitalization in Yara is it is happening on all levels, going from the more traditional production units that you in a way... In the future, of course, you don't need people on the ground. You can, in a way, sit essentially and operate it like in the oil industry with the platforms, just as an example. That's one way of digitalization that will certainly continue. You have, I mentioned the farmers. You have all the interaction with customers, certainly. I think that you touched a little bit also on this. You need, in a way, some innovation style. You need open innovation. You need input from external sources. You need to do experimentation. You maybe need to invest in some venture, etc., to get the input and get some changes. And all this is, of course, you need also to put in to cooperate with other companies. If you take an example into the food industry, if you buy a bread in a store and you know that this food is produced by, say, green production, and then you pay somewhat extra, consumers may be willing to pay extra for that. But then you need cooperation with the food companies. You need Nestle and all these big companies to say, well, we need green food, then we need green input, and you need cooperation. So those kind of cooperation, in a way, to be able to deliver products that customers are willing to pay for, is also something that is very important in this transformation and digitalization, I would say. So you need cooperation, you need innovation, you need organization setup in order to handle it. Yeah,
that's right. Up your avenue is the business model, the value chain thinking, and the networking.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot more use of the term business model. It sort of arose in the internet heydays around 2000, the boom and the bust of the internet. But the term internet business model sort of survived all of this. And I think people felt that they needed a new term to describe all this crazy stuff that was going on that didn't seem to have any real explanations. And prior to this, you know, we had a very comfortable view of a business. We had a value chain. It sort of... you know, it's the old industrial enterprise. It takes raw materials and goods and components and so forth in on one end, and out comes the product, and there's a clean handover to the customer. And we have an internal R&D department that sort of works on what's going to happen next. Now, Amit Sasson and I, one of my colleagues, we did a little empirical survey of the types of firms in the OECD area. And it turns out that the firms that have this value chain logic constitute about 18%. And so all the other ones do something else than take some inputs in and transform them. And so for a long time, I've been working on alternative models, thinking about large category of firms that... that really what they do is they enable a networking of their users or customers. And Schibsted is, of course, a good example of this in many of its new businesses, as is Telenor also. And then there are organizations that, as their primary value creation, solve their customers' and clients' problems. The healthcare sector is characterized by this. We don't want standard solutions. And then we have an increase in a fourth one at this point and this is an interesting business model. They invest in some assets and make them available. We see it strongly in cloud server computing and so forth. So the landscape is broader. And in this world of platforms, of open organizations, open innovations, and so forth, we get a lot more mobilization of these various models. And I was very fascinated by what you said about, not just delivering a bag or a crate or a container of fertilizer, you know, to the farmer, but actually advising them very specifically on what they need for their particular crop, given season, weather, soil, all of those factors that are coming in, you're moving much more closely in that part into problem solving each case, as opposed to just having a product that's sort of segmented out there. And then for some of the others, you're moving closer towards the network part. So I think we see a greater variety here in the way that firms create value and play on it, in addition to playing with others.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And you need to network, you need to have platforms that works together with other in this whole value chain, so to say. If you take another example, is that farming and is of course something that you really can utilize in order to carbon capture. That is could be very efficient if you find system to do it. And of course, Yara has interaction with all the farmers. Then you need in a way a system to how to store the carbon in the ground. And then the farmer can get carbon credits. And if you can put that into system, if you can then work together with other platform players, other companies, finding a carbon credit system that works, it is already working, by the way. So this is an example of how you, in a way, can create a whole new business opportunity, because you already have the interaction with the farmer, you know a lot about it, and then work along those lines gives a lot of new opportunities, as an example.
Yeah, but these are super good examples. So if we're going to try to lift this to a more generic advice, so how do you build that culture or capabilities in a transformation? Because you're transforming your business model. That's what I'm hearing. So what's your experience? How do you get on that path? Because one thing you can say that Yara since 1905 has consciously changed, but maybe things are going faster now. So how are you thinking of that tools we need to get that moving?
Well, it's no easy answer to that, to be fair. It is, a complex situation, so to say. So you need, first of all, you need the people and the executives to really understand this and take on that challenge. A lot to do with the culture, a lot to do with, I mean, it's so that culture you need to build over years, of course. So, and then you need to build an agile culture. You need to have organization that is in a way adaptive to changes, and that you can move people from different positions and flexibility, I would say. So here you're talking about building an organization over time to adapt to it, and then in a way, then you need also to find an organizing of Yara in this case that fits with these challenges, because you need some kind of responsibility, some way to handle these new initiatives, networking, etc. So that is something that we spend a lot of time on, that organizational development, I would say.
And I have to give you a lot of credit. In your annual report, you have a page called Material Topics on how Yara understands them. And it's going through the people side, the planet side, prosperity side, and the governance side. And I recommend all readers, listeners, to read this. But one of the points you have is entrepreneurship and agility. That's what we're talking about. And you say about our understanding is our ability to design, launch, and run new business models to exploit business opportunities. That's exactly what we're saying now. So you frame it very well. But can you follow it through times? Do you have any particular KPIs, or is it the success in the market? How do you really follow that traction?
Oh, it's built out of KPIs around these initiatives, as you said. So that if you take the CEO and the top executives, their short-term incentives is very much linked to the these initiatives and delivering on the KPIs on a yearly basis, if take this example. And that is monitored quarterly. So we have some kind of red, yellow, green lights, meaning if you're able to deliver on the track to deliver, etc. And of course, some of these KPIs are in a way more I would say subject. I mean, it's not all of them can be put into a figure, not data driven. So it is a combination, I would say. But certainly you can monitor CO2 emission as an example. Easy to have a KPI, etc. If you have this innovation, it is more judgmental of what you are doing. So you have then a way to see that you should do something. You have a program that you can enter into these and these areas and do that. But to be very KPI specific, data driven is harder, of course, in these.
But Øystein, from the research, what does research tell us about companies who needs to go through or have succeeded going through this transformation? Is there some learnings we can generalize from it?
Well, I think that there are some fundamental learnings here. And sort of first one of them is the importance of balancing exploration and exploitation. One of the ways to think of that is that the pace of adaptation in the firm is a function of that balance. So the more you explore, the more rapidly you change. The more you exploit, the more you stabilize and improve what you have. I'd like to go really far back in time, and even if we're sort of talking about the current, there was a cyberneticist in the 50s and early 60s by the name of William Ross Ashby. He was really a psychiatrist by training, but he didn't really make that much of a name for himself as a psychiatrist, but he did as a cyberneticist. And his first book was called Design for a Brain. So he's just really trying to figure out what kind of governance system, would the brain have to represent in order to control the body. And his work and some of his fellow researchers at the time really influenced about everything we know about organization theory, but also about computing, robotics, and so forth, this modern world. And he formulated a law that it sounds a little dense at the outset, but I'll try to expand it. He says, only variety can absorb variety. And by that, he means that if you're trying to deal with a diverse, complex environment, and you're trying to survive in it, you have to have the requisite variety on the inside, meaning you have to have the capabilities that allow you to understand what's going on and the capabilities required to take the necessary actions. And so this comes back to the explore and exploit. The more the world changes, the more you exploit. And I think that's what you're saying, Trond. At 60% is on all these new initiatives, which really says something about both your strategy and the pace in your environment. Now, there's a little caveat here, and that is that, for capabilities, being good at stuff, you have to practice. So if one has a company that for the longest time has exploited and then all of a sudden says the world's changing, so now we got to invent, it's going to take them a while to sort of get into that mode. And that's why I think it's very impressive that you for a long time now have done this. So not only do you benefit probably from the gains you're getting, but you're also getting better and better at it. And I think that's one. I don't think there's any magic. We just sort of wave the wand and now we do it. I think like with most things in life, you get good at what you practice. And then I think just coming back to some of what you said, it's pervasive, the particularly the digital. And so then it comes in culture and it comes in, everybody has to know about it. You can't sort of have the old digital department or the old IT department's going to deal with the IT stuff and the rest of the people deal with business, because the business is becoming digital. And this touches a little bit on one of the key organizing principles we've had of division of labor. There's some forms of the labor here you can't just outsource to somebody. Everybody has to be digital, to work within it. And I think that's a huge part of the transformation.
Yeah, I support that. Really, I agree with you. Yeah.
And that brings us up to, and I think you said very well, Øystein, is about complementary expertise, capability, diversity, and you alluded to it several times that this is the part of how Yara is working. And if we now take the board perspective, you being the chair, and looking at both the competence which you oversee at the board, but also, of course, together with the board, oversee the management. How do you think about that complementary and let's call it the support and challenge perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you, first of all, you need a board with competence that covers all the main areas within, like in this case, the RR challenges. So certainly. You need expertise in the traditional downstream and that industry history itself. Important to understand that to be efficient and streamline in production. Of course, you need then in the other end of the scale, you need people really understanding the digital challenge and the transformation and really have best practice and understanding of that. Then you need financial understanding, how market works and all this kind, because you're a listed company, of course. And you need people with expertise within large corporations, how to run it. It is complex. So you have all this kind of expertise. And of course, best is that everybody can cover it being board member. That's not always the case, but you need in a way broader experience and being able to play on all these areas. So certainly I would say that that's it in itself is important because then you can also challenge the management and CEO if you have those kind of capabilities. So I would say that in Yara it's a performance driven type of governance system, both within the organization and also within the board, in a way to deliver on the change and transformation. That is something that is I would say, is in the forefront of this. But I mean, you know, the way that the board need to follow up, monitor, etc., but they also need to challenge. They need to challenge the management. And often the board believe that you need sometimes move even faster than the organization is doing. That is a part of the challenge, which is to have this being restless, being you need to change, you need to do it faster, etc. So it is that balance.
But you know this saying that when you launch a strategy 1 year ago, then finally it comes down to actually, the employee is going to execute it, and then you want to change the strategy again. Mm. That's always the dilemma in yeah. practical world, like to find that synchronization.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There has been a discussion in academia, Øystein, about the board asking the right questions or having the right answers. And I think the conclusion is that more or less now, as I understand it, is about having the right questions. But does that require, which Trond kind of alluded to, that you need domain expertise, or can you have more generalists? What's the trend now saying?
I think this is a difficult one. I like the question. That's also how science advances. You know, science advances through the really good questions, and then we have all of the marginal answers to them. And that's probably also what then gets replicated at the board level. I think this issue of diversity and the dynamics is really important because the organization is in a constantly changing environment that requires new things. Yara, for example, is now going in, although you've dealt with ammonia, you're becoming in some ways an energy producer. And you're probably going to change a lot over the next 5 to 10 years, probably more than the company's company changed in the prior 10. And so, how do you deal with the board getting the necessary update. Because there are some things that are general, but I believe that it requires some ability to at least work on the articulation of a vision and the understanding of the company's mission and how it relates to the actual capabilities of the firm. And good vision statements are seldom general. They're good because they say something that is meaningful. And so I think I don't have the answer, but I would expect it's a difficult thing to work with in practice. How do you assure that renewal of the competencies of the board?
No, it's a good question. I think that not only the board but also the top management certainly need to have enough input from external factors in order to follow what's going on. As an example, in Yara board, we from time to time have some expertise coming into the board, telling what's the development in these and these areas. So that is, we're setting some time to educate ourselves on what's going on. We have discussed in Yara, as in other companies, should there be some kind of advisory board, this kind of expertise sitting, telling what is the trend, what's happening on, can you give the right advice? And that is often experts within some areas. I'm a little bit uncertain whether that is the right way to go, because sometimes that is, you don't really have the link to the advisory board and the board itself. So it's living on its own, that's a little bit my experience, but many companies use that system. So I would say that in a way to challenge the board itself with the management and getting some input and these doing evaluations and constantly improve yourself is important. And I do believe that if you should work well in a board, one thing is to have the expertise within a field, but you need also to understand how to run a complex international organization, because that in itself is important in order to be able to deliver the changes. Because one thing is to say, well, this is, but you need, in a way, to adapt to it. That is could be very hard.
And just going through and just listening to you, Yara is truly complex. 122 production facilities, truly global. With environment, it is complex, and I think it will never underestimate it. But how do you make, going back to Øystein's famous quote, how do you make this complex world simplified or try to take down the essence to simplify it and try to then to make those initiatives as you explained?
Well, there's no easy answer
to
that.
No, exactly.
It is you need in a way to decide some of the most important value factors and how to transform yourself and focus on those.
Exactly. I can see we can continue for a long time. But finally, so what's the next themes for Yara now? Is to continue on kind of the journey you're already on, or is it any major revealing topics coming up?
I would say that we have a lot of opportunities if we go into this green ammonia, the shipping, the having alternative as the hydrogen in transport system. You have this carbon capture. You have digitalization. There are so many things that we and go into the also food value chain. There are so many opportunities here. So there is no big new thing that we're sitting and say, well, that's what we're going to do. We have to transform and deliver on these possibilities.
With that, there is nothing else for me to say, but thank you to you both for coming in today. And I hope all of you listeners have enjoyed this episode of Stay Ahead. Thank you very much.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.